Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. Be joined shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. And tonight, our resident legal expert will be joining us this evening, Mr. Hank Seaton. So if you got anything, any kind of questions that you would like to ask transportation law related, you can go ahead and press number one. That gets you in the call queue, and we'll get to you as quickly as we can. Tonight, we are facing a whole bunch of different things that are going on in the marketplace. Right now, diesel pricing seems to have been unchanged from last week, but I suspect that that definitely is going to change with all the stuff that's going on with the Colonial Pipeline situation. But as of last week and coming into this week, the national average price of diesel fuel was up by 0.6 percentage points, with a national average price of diesel fuel at $3.14 per gallon. So last week we had the road check inspection blitz that was going on, and that created a tighter spot market. So the International Road Check Week typically brings a drop in truck posts on DAT's one low board networks. Many carriers take time off while others are delayed by inspections. Normally the drop is around 9%, but last week truck posts fell by 17%. Reefer carriers typically take time off in greater numbers compared to dry vans and flatbed carriers. They recorded a 20% fewer equipment posts last week, showing that the national average rate rose for each equipment type, with reefer and flatbed averages above the $3 per mile mark. Taking a look and going a deeper dive into each particular segment, starting off with the dry van portion of the report. Taking a look, deeper look into the northeastern portion of the United States, we're showing that the national average spot market rate for dry vans was at $2.33 per mile. Dropping down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern region, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for dry vans was at $2.59. Coming up into the Midwest, we're showing average rates for dry vans at $2.79. Dropping down to the to the south central region, we're showing average spot market rates for dry vans at $2.39. And wrapping up the west coast, we're showing average outbound spot market rates for dry vans at $2.69. Switching gears over to the flatbed portion of the report, starting out in the northeastern corridor, we're showing average outbound spot market rates at $2.92 per mile. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $3.24 per mile. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at $3.31. And coming out of the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average rate at $2.82. And wrapping up, coming out of the west coast, we're showing average outbound rates at $2.56. And jumping over to the temperature control portion of the report, we're showing an outbound spot market rate coming out of the northeast at $2.54. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average outbound rate at $2.81. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing average outbound rates at $3.16. Coming out of the south central region, we're showing average outbound rates at $2.80. And wrapping up, coming out of the west coast, we're showing average outbound rates at $3.12 per mile. And that, ladies and gentlemen, wraps up this week's Trend Lines report. And with that being said, and without any further ado, let me go and grab my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Good evening, Chuck. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
I cannot complain. Lots and lots going on in the marketplace right now. I can only imagine with road check wrapping up from last week, I know rates were probably experienced a little. We just talked about how the rates experienced a little bit of a spike, and I can only imagine with the whole Colonial Pipeline situation and possible fuel shortages. I can see that the rates probably are getting ready to probably maybe go up a little bit more again.
Oh yeah, I think they could possibly just skyrocket. I don't think we have seen, if this thing plays out, I don't think we've seen anything like this probably since the when that thing happened in Iran in 1979. And they kicked the Shah out, and we saw our last real fuel shortage, and people were lined up by the carload trying to buy 5-gallon jerry cans full of gasoline. And I think we're probably heading that way right now, unless some 11th hour miracle happens somehow.
Well, they say they talk like they should have this thing, hopefully. But then again, you don't know if that's just trying to keep people from panicking or not. They are saying that things should be back online by the end of the week, hopefully.
I hope so, for the sake of our economies and people have been through enough, in the last 14 months with COVID and losing jobs and losing companies and just the hell on earth that people have been through, and now all of a sudden, if they're not able to buy gasoline to do what they have to do, to whether it's to commute to work or whatever, or to fill their trucks, I think just people have been through enough already. You know, when's it going to end?
Well, with all that being said, let's go ahead and bring on our special guest, our resident legal expert, to maybe also catch us up on some happenings that's going on from the latest that may be coming out of Washington, D.C. on a regulatory front and some other things that may be coming down the pike with the changing of the guard and the regime that is taking place in Washington, D.C. Is there anything that from a political standpoint that we may need to be aware of or keep our eyes open? So with that being said, let's welcome in our resident legal expert, Mr. Hank Seaton. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
Rico, Chuck, good to be
hey,
with
how
you
are
tonight.
You? Always good to have you on.
Well, I don't think anything is good coming out of Washington. I hate to be Debbie Downer, but...
our list going into the new year wasn't
very encouraging, and after the first 100 days, we can't see it's a whole lot brighter. I think for the majority of industry, the real kill switch is the importance of the independent contractor model, and it seems like it's getting buffeted at all angles. The Department of Labor, as expected, canned a test that would have been very favorable to independent contractors. The Ninth Circuit in California lifted the stay on AB5. that fight's not over, but boy, it's the ninth inning for that. And, Congress is still playing around with the PRO Act, which really stands for protecting right to organize. It's a very very pro-union kind of piece of legislation, but hidden in it is the redefinition of the independent contractor so that there's no way that an owner-operator can meet that standard. And that's really the issue. The folks in Washington don't seem to appreciate that the owner-operator model is a choice, not involuntary slavery, don't seem to appreciate that it's a blue-collar entrepreneurship at its best. So, it remains, it's heartening, I guess, to say that when you can get OIDA, TIA, and ATA to all agree on something, you really got a trifecta there. It seems as though everybody's finally coming to the party and pretty well speaking with the united voice that the owner-operator model is something worth saving. That's a purely political battle. Other things that are a little concerning is you may have seen in transport topics, the new administration thinks maybe we ought to go back to the SMS methodology and
oh my God.
The IRT. I mean, you know, you would have thought that we stuck a fork in that five or six years ago.
I was thinking
about writing a piece entitled "Cicadas and SMS Methodology." After 10 years dormant, here it comes again. But
what's the ration? There's got to be some ration somewhere, I would think, unless all of D.C. has gone insane. What's the ration? The rationale behind that train of thought?
We really don't know. That assumes that you've got thinking minds and not politically driven decisions. Obviously, over the past 5 years, the idea of converting a desktop audit into a safety rating so that carriers large and small would have satisfactory safety ratings is about halfway there. The agency is using desktop audits very extensively, but if you pass, they don't give you a SAT. So go figure. Right. You know, that defeats it. It's a whole lot cheaper than trying to monitor every violation. You got to realize there's a political constituency behind SMS, and it really is that it gives plaintiffs bar something to argue about. It gives vendors something to sell, and it gives insurance companies some kind of rusty thermometer. And those three constituents want some kind of definitive to combat or to increase insurance premiums. And it's interesting to note that one of the other things is in the bills floating around Congress is one to increase the minimum amount of insurance from $1 million to $2 million or more. You know, if you think you're paying a lot for it now, that would only further cripple the small guy. We're noticing that there are far more applications for new authority. There are 10,000 a month, which is incredible. That's as many as 120,000 new carriers a year. They can all get their insurance. But, you know, when those guys get in business, they're all of a sudden going to be hit with maybe $25,000 per unit. You got to ask, right, where is that money going to come from? Obviously, it may be that the shippers end up taking that in shorts or something, but to say that the economy is going to be any better as a result of that, I just don't know. So I think the IRT, which is this crazy theory that you can go out and start considering either be like the SAT. Nobody wants that, neither the big nor the small, but that's kind of baked into the cake. So's the possibility of raising insurance. And finally, this survival of the owner-operator model. I think people are really beginning to get concerned in la-la land now. Since the stay's been lifted, a lot of people were taking drastic measures before, but I imagine that will really heat up.
Well, I remember when California, when they finally did pass the legislation, a bunch of the big carriers actually moved out of the state who had been using owner-operators.
Yeah, I think if we'd been a little more precocious, we would have brought a couple of warehouses and Sparks. I think a lot of guys are going to hand it off to somebody at Sparks to go on into California. Yep. I was talking 100%. To a large carrier today, and he said, "Well, Hank, you remember we always had this New York City surcharge." He said, "We're putting in a California surcharge."
Yeah, I can see that in a lot of cases because the cost of operating there is just, it's so high. Fuel is high. I remember years ago when we were running a lot of Californians, and this is before insurance went crazy. This is 20-odd years ago, and the insurance company came to me and they said, we don't want you to have any more than three trucks in the state of California at any given time, because we don't want the exposure, because the settlements have been so big in California, they were terrified. So we had to limit it to three trucks at a time. So I can see all that, you know, a California surcharge, just like the New York surcharge, just because it is so expensive to operate there.
Well, you know, I really don't want to be doom and gloom, but I'm working with a carrier. He's got a couple of hundred trucks, and he had a driver who rear-ended somebody in California, and his insurance company has already said, here, take all the insurance. And he comes to me and say, what the hell do I do? And, you know, at that point, the question is, you can drag it out, but the victim is injured pretty bad, and they're going to say you rear-ended them. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room,
right,
you know, from this being a tremendous judgment, other than how deep are the carrier's pockets. And,
yeah,
you know, that's what the big boys say is so unfair, that, you know, small guy has got a secured creditor who's got a mortgage on his truck, but isn't able to pay that Werner $40 million bill. And that's the reason some tort reform is really needed.
Oh, my God, yeah. It's definitely overdue because, you know, look at your client that you're talking about. You know, yeah, the driver was probably in the wrong. He rear-ended somebody. Somebody got injured badly. Does that mean it should be the end of that trucking company? Because really, when you take away their insurance and they have to go out to the market and get insurance, it may be the end of them. It's just not right. It's not fair.
Well, and, you know, it really is a poor reflection on my profession, because juries can be so easily manipulated by the argument that, look, the poor guy is irrevocably harmed. Send a message to the truck driver, send a message to the carrier, and certainly send a message to the insurer. You know, and then people tend to vote with their heart, not their head. And there's, you know, you get canceled if you say, well, let's put some perspective in this. Because, you know, a very sympathetic victim, particularly in a certain inclined jurisdiction, it isn't going to matter whether you got Clarence there or who you got.
Oh, you're right. You know, but trucking is such a necessity that we can't keep just forcing all these small and medium-sized carriers out of business. That's not going to that's not doing any good for anybody, and that's what this is doing.
Well, I've been trying to make some headway with the regulators by reminding them we have a national transportation policy, and if you read it, it's supposed to be how you manage transportation and how and what the goals of federal law is. And among it is to encourage an effectively, competitively, privately owned motor carrier system.
Right.
And, you know, among other things is to see that small shippers in rural communities and small businessmen have an equal chance. And, you know, we've gotten pretty far afield from that. I think the unintended consequences of what the bureaucrats are doing and what is going on in the court system is the antithesis of the kind of transportation system we ought to be encouraging.
100%, because what's happening is at some point people aren't going to want to invest in this industry, and it started now with the insurance companies. They don't want to invest. You know, it's not, insurance is nothing more than, it's a bet for the insurance company. They're betting on your ability to do things right. And it certainly reduces their odds when you have these huge claims. So I think everybody's got to get on board with this. We have a bunch of lawyers all over the United States, and there's the odd one in Canada that, you know, with the billboards that are, you know, get rich quick, sue a trucker. And somehow that's got to, we have to stop that, because this is really having a bad effect. I talk to people all the time that have had to shut down their trucking companies, and they were good operators because of the fact that one or two crashes, and some of them weren't totally their fault, but they still had, they couldn't get insurance.
Well, you know, the safety system was originally set up that management was placed out of service if they systemically required or permitted their drivers to violate safety regulations. There had to be some causal relationship back to management's indifference towards operating safely, not just the fact that you know, it's a game of roulette, and you lost a couple of hands, not because of any breach in safety etiquette by the carrier, but you know, it ultimately puts the company and everybody that works with it out of business. And you know, there's no cause and effect even necessarily shown.
Yeah.
And, of course, that particularly happens if you've got the law of small numbers and, you know, you don't have 4,000 trucks to spread the few random accidents over.
Right. You know, and the smaller carriers are, you know, some of them, especially the guys with two or three trucks, they're having problems all over trying to hire good drivers or experienced drivers. So they're taking drivers a lot of times right out of school. That's where some of the problem comes from, is that there's such a shortage of qualified drivers that people are getting desperate. And of course, when they get desperate, they do stupid things and hire people that they probably wouldn't normally hire. And then there goes your safety rating.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, I think we're beginning to see this across industries with the unemployment records. When you get to be a welfare state and you take the necessity or the incentive of working out, you get people who are just not, particularly if there's no way to get ahead, people that just don't want to take a job. I remember it's been 4 or 5 years ago now. I had a client who won two contracts, one in Oklahoma and one in Pennsylvania, and they were all dedicated contracts. And after a year and a half into it, he went back to the shipper and said, "I love the Oklahoma because I can find drivers there, but I can't find anybody in Pennsylvania. There was some kind of stimulus program going on at the time, and the shortage was obvious based upon on zip code and the alternatives."
Right.
So you know, I see that availability of truck drivers is ultimately going to be locational specific.
100%.
In addition to the fact that the older guys are just hanging it up.
Yeah, I think the average age of a driver is now 55 years old. So that's average, and you've got a lot of, you know, you got a lot of 25 and 30 year olds there. So you can imagine how many guys there are that are well over 60. So this is a problem that the industry has not done a good job addressing. No one has, and it keeps it's funny, it's an ongoing problem that we all face, and it keeps rearing its head throughout our industry. You can't move goods, people can't get drivers, can't get insurance. It's just every single part of our industry footprint of this problem, which we still can't seem to get around as an industry. You know, I know so many small carriers that are good operators, run great little businesses and medium-sized businesses, and they're starving for drivers. They just can't get them. And it's not even regional specific. You know, I know people throughout America, except places like maybe Montana and the Dakotas, where it seems to be a lot of rural people that grow up on ranches and places like that and get exposed to heavy equipment at a young age. But other than that, the driver shortage is all over. And how, my question, I'll throw this to both of you gentlemen, how much of that driver shortage is a actual labor shortage versus a money shortage? Are we just not paying enough?
That's a great question. They you would think if you throw enough money at it, but even at some of these situations, that's a hard one to balance, because there's only so much money that is available to go around to even remain profitable, because at some point it's not even it wouldn't even be worth the it's not worth the investment, in my opinion. There's only going to be so much you can be able to pay in order for it to, I guess my analogy would be that you can only charge but so much to for something to be fair, so to speak. Like if a can of Coca-Cola, I don't think you're going to be able to sell a can of Coca-Cola for $10. But if everything with inflation and everything, you factor all that stuff into it, if you very easily could drive the price of something like a can of Coca-Cola up to $10, if everybody was quote unquote to be paid a fair price, so to speak.
I think it's what we think. Go ahead, Hank.
No, I think that part of it has to do with the particular long haul trucking. Are people working to live or living to work? You know, the traditional model is it takes a special type of person that has the entrepreneurial zeal and is willing to do the sleeper cab routine for an extended period of time. I remember, 15, 20 years ago, we had eastbound and down overload trucking. We had shows that, were showing that the life on the road was something to be merited. I think there are a lot of people that make very good truck drivers and want to be home every night and stay within a 250-mile radius, and they don't want to be in Utah one day and in Kansas the next. So I think maybe the aptitude of the younger generation for that kind of lifestyle has changed. I think traditionally when the family farms went the way of big agriculture, a lot of guys who had who could work on trucks and enjoyed it and wanted to keep their family on the farm fell into that over-the-road niche. And I think that's why so many of the long-haul carriers were out in Nebraska and Iowa and places like that. Even the pandemic may be changing the aptitude of people for that. You know, trucking really, really survived COVID very well. Most of the trucking companies I know, the drivers got in the truck and they delivered the goods, and there wasn't anybody, hiding out in the shadows or any disruption about people looking for stimulus. I think trucking held up very well. But now with this independent contractor issue, I'm really afraid that we're just going to hasten the day that you have this automated trucking thing. And, the warehouses, not going to be any job for warehousemen, and trucking will be diverted somehow because, like you say, at some point, with all the benefits and overtime comes to trucking. If overtime just comes to trucking alone, and you go to $15 an hour, there'll be all kinds of encouragement just to say, okay, Mr. Walmart, that's fine. I'll sleep out here in the truck for 2 days because I'm going to be on the clock.
That would people would get unloaded a lot quicker, I'll tell you, if all of a sudden they were being charged to, to have a truck sit at a dock. There's still an awful lot of docks around where they, they really take advantage. Mind you, I must say this whole drop and hook thing that's been going on the last couple of years, it has eliminated an awful lot of that. The, with because of the push, because of the ELD, a lot of the large and medium-sized carriers and some of the courier companies, the package companies like UPS and FedEx, they've gotten right into the drop and hook thing. So I think that makes a much better use of a truck driver's time and the equipment that he or she is driving to just have them go in there, drop a trailer and hook up to another one.
Well, yeah, a drop and a hook is really a friend to a small carrier because it cuts out the detention, it cuts out the cost of the vehicle, and most likely, if you don't have to count it and it's sealed on both ends, your cargo exposure drops. So, there's a lot of good things about drop and hook, whether you're an owner operator or you got your own authority. I'm all in favor of it. There are real issues, though. The devil's in the detail about being sure that trailer is maintained and knowing who owns the trailer and who's pulling the load off the lot. So,
100%.
It's not that easy. I'm seeing some just wicked contract terms in order to pull a shipper's trailer.
Well, I can only imagine. Now, that's one of my big concerns about the whole drop and hook thing is drivers not checking trailers that they're not familiar with properly. And that's a recipe for disaster. And then you have a driver drop a trailer in a drop yard. There's damage done to the trailer. Maybe the driver that's picking up that trailer doesn't notice that damage because it's in a dark yard at night and there's a big scrape along the side or whatever. And this is where a trained driver that can recognize on a safety aspect what a proper circle check should be. And check the brakes, check tires, check tire pressure, wheel seals, cross members, all those things. I know a lot of drivers out there don't do those things. And now more than ever, if the driver's involved in a drop and hook situation, they really need to be careful of that because you have no idea, number one, for the sake of your licensing, your freedom, but also for your safety. You really want to check that trailer over. And that's not a five-minute walk around a trailer kicking tires. That's actually getting out there with a tire gauge and checking and making sure those tires are good and that your brake seals, your brakes are good and your wheel seals are good because those are all problems.
A lot of that, though, when it gets to traditional OTR refrigerated is reinventing the wheel. For years, the intermodal guys were pulling steamship line chassis.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, the Uniform Intermodal Interchange Agreement came up. And it's got some really wicked provisions in it in terms of the liability of the performing carrier for indemnifying the steamship line. And there were always problems about poorly maintained chassis.
Oh, yeah.
They got some law in that. They got this idea about the concealed damages and the anti-indemnity aspect of that. If somebody's going to maintain a trailer pool, they need to have a spotting service that comes by and performs regular inspections on it. It's a little bit easier when the trailers are going out and back. I think probably Convoy is becoming the most successful trailer provider, and you know, I think it can be done. But, Chuck, you're absolutely right. Getting that inspection, knowing when the damage was done, being sure you've got fizz down and you know the indemnity obligations, it's not just as easy as, oh, here's a trailer.
No, not at all. And then reporting that damage, you know, when you're hooking up so that nobody, you know, if there's a big gouge down the side, reporting it to whoever's in charge, whoever owns the equipment or is looking after arranging this, so you can get the liability removed from yourself. You know, that's really important, because the last thing you want to do is pull a load and be responsible for damages that happened in a drop yard. And if you watch some of those shag operators, now some of them are great, but we've had issues with customers' places with our trailers where the local shunt or shag driver just destroyed one of our trailers. It was just getting too cocky and careless. You know, it reaches a point where a driver is too familiar with the layout of the land and the equipment. And Zig Ziglar, may he rest in peace, called it unconscious competence. And that's when it actually could get dangerous, because people got cocky and they lost that edge of fear to be careful. And that's when accidents happen and damages prevail. And right now, with the cost of trailers, you don't want to be responsible for replacing one, trust me.
You got that right, because that's something that has definitely gone through the roof with the shortage. I mean, you talk about shortages. We're talking about gas shortages, but the shortages of available dry van and reefer trailers right now, I don't know about flatbeds, but I know that they are very scarce, very hard to come by right now as far as dry vans, especially dry vans, and even in some reefers.
Yeah. If you want to have, just for entertainment, if you have time, look in Truck Trader or the Truck Paper. There's usually hundreds of pages of used dry vans, 53-foot 102 dry vans with swing doors. You would be shocked that other than a bunch of new ones that are non-existent, because they're not really for sale because they're not on the ground because they're not built yet,
right,
there's hardly anything in there. Because we went looking a couple weeks ago for a client, and apparently this is all as a result of the carrier, some of the large carriers and the parcel people renting trailers last October, November, December, and not giving them back like they always do. They've just disappeared from the rental market. And that's all over the place. So, you know, that's coast to coast in Canada and the U.S. So, yeah, that's a real problem. And, of course, the manufacturers are saying they can't get all their raw materials in because they've had disruptions to their supply chains as well. So, yeah, it
right.
is definitely it's the perfect storm. And, of course, if we're talking reefers, you've got some components that aren't coming for a while. They can't even get cars off the apparently GM has gone crazy building new cars, but they can't ship them because they're missing components to finish them off. And they're hoping that the prices will go up. Apparently, they'll be able to charge more in 3 months than they can today. So we are living in somewhat uncharted waters.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting with, you know, things are being in short supply. People are not being able to, like I say, but the main thing is, and I'm not sure of the components, but I think the main component that people are running, that they're running short on is the computer chips.
That's one of the main ones. We're so dependent on these, and there's none. So they say there's none available. You know, maybe this is, who knows? You know, maybe this is the way it's supposed to be. Maybe somebody is actually doing something to mess up supply chains to get more money. We were talking about it the other day. I'm sure everybody on the line has heard about the increase in the cost of lumber. Where is that coming from? Is that really, if we look at the very bottom line, is that all a result of commodity specialists that buy and sell commodities, traders, and they're playing the market and they're just taking advantage? What's the real story behind it?
Well, for the longest time, I know that they were talking about doing, because that's one of the things with the housing prices that shot up. You just got the mills and stuff just did not have, they were shut down for the longest time and just didn't have, weren't able to produce the capacity. And so now we're kind of like just reaping what's to come of that whole situation, though, that they hadn't been able to get back up on production standards as of yet.
I heard the same thing. I don't quite believe it. That's my take on it. I just think could be a great opportunity for some commodity traders to raise prices. Maybe not, but it could be. Because for lumber to go up as much as 243% in some cases, if you could even get it, that's insane. And I don't think the lumber truckers are getting that much more money.
I think that's pretty well stable. Chuck, maybe when you and I were talking earlier about what is this Canadian dumping about, is the fact that, Canadian lumber is coming this way because, I'd heard rumors of, you guys having a surplus of it. I don't know if there's any impediment to it coming into the Southland, but I have heard the same stories you're talking about in terms of shortage of lumber, and you would think that that's pretty well not like copper wire. You know, it's not limited supply.
Right. That lumber thing between Canada and the United States, that's been going on for over 40 years on softwood lumber. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where we stand today on that one because we're not involved. My God, I bet you we don't handle 20 or 30 loads of lumber in an entire year in the whole organization. It's just not something that we handle a lot of. And there are companies that that broker and haul all sorts of it. The Canadian wood that would be coming down to the U.S. would be softwood only. They mill an awful lot of hardwood in the U.S., which they don't do a lot of in Canada. It's too cold. And that shot up way in price. So it's not just us dumping because they need hardwood as well for construction for certain tasks. So hard to say. It's certainly interesting times. Hank, what's your take on what's going on in Michigan with closing this pipeline number 5?
Chuck, you're the first one that brought it to my attention. What goes on up in the hand of Michigan is, we kind of tend to focus on the problems of Detroit. And I'm really out for lunch. other than know that a lot of my friends in Michigan aren't any too pleased with the governor up there.
Well, if you have friends or clients in Ohio, Pennsylvania, you certainly have a lot of friends in Ontario, and if you have any in Quebec, we're all going to feel the wrath of this thing. So it's not just it's not just Canadians getting punished here.
Mm.
And it's supposed to be shutting down, I guess, tonight at midnight. So it should be. The oil flow is getting a double whammy. Now, maybe this is a way to persuade the trucking industry to start using other non-fossil burning fuels. But we're not set up for it. You know that.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting with the, hopefully, like I say, with the pipelines and everything, they definitely need to get back in order, hopefully sooner than later. And hopefully, like I say, it didn't last until the end of the week. But it's going to be really interesting, especially on the, from what I understand, that the pipeline that's affected with the security breach, that's mainly going to be southeastern east coast type of thing. I'm not sure how far reaching it's going to go as far as how it's going to affect the Midwest and out west, if they're going to have any effects from this whole situation or not. So it's really going to be really interesting. By the time Thursday, Friday rolls around, it's really going to be interesting. I know for myself, you know, I'm hoping to try to be able to top off my tank tonight when I pull out. But I got enough fuel to complete my run that I got set up for this evening. But come Thursday and Friday, if I'm not able to get any fuel tonight, it's going to be some freight going to be sitting on some docks.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let me ask you something.
You know, guys, I think there's a real nasty underside to all of this technology that we've gotten into. We've gotten to the point that we live by the computer and the convenience and, you know, the swipe and the thing comes in the mail. But, you know, I had a major client who was hit with malware, and, man, you know, it could have been two people in the closet that managed to steal this stuff. I think we all are concerned that you know, our international enemies may be able to hack into all kinds of things. We wake up some morning and find out our own missiles have blown up our cities.
God.
But just the sheer hackers, you know, my wife came in and said, "Honey, you know, we've got free Netflix, but I can't get our credit card to work." Well, I looked at it, and it was very clear that this was part of a scam.
Yeah.
You know, this the return address wasn't even Netflix.
Yeah,
and by the time you went on down to it, it found out that they wanted to get even more personal information. Well, I said, "Look, don't do that." And my secretary went online and found out that somebody in Eastern Europe or something was just assuming that anybody who had a telephone had Netflix and was sending the same spamola out. And I guess then they were just going to troll for responses. But, you know, I was worried about being so compromised that every utility or everything that I've got that's on an automatic draft, I was going to go change all the credit cards and all the passwords. And, you know, I'm not a target by any means to be maliciously scammed. But, you can search anybody on the web and find out who their friends are, who they party with, and where they're hanging out.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I know. You know, you really need to be careful on things like Facebook and Instagram, what you put out there. You've got to just be so careful because you don't know who's going to see it and what they're going to do with that information. So don't put anything, my advice to anybody and everybody is don't put anything on there that you don't want your worst enemy in the world to see. If it's real benign that you're sitting down having a big plate of sushi or Chinese food, well, that's not so bad. But don't go into personal stuff. It just could bite you in the backside. You know, speaking of malware and all this sort of things, I had a meeting with a gentleman a couple of years ago in the U.S. down in New Jersey, and he runs a large, large fleet of refrigerated trucks all over the United States. And someone broke in to his system and shut them right down. This company has over 500 trucks, and they demanded a ransom. and he did the right thing, and he went to the FBI, and they put their best men on it. And for 2 days, not one of those 500 or however many trucks moved an inch. And he kept saying, what are we doing? Well, we're working on it. We're working on it. Finally, on the third day, he went against what the FBI told him, which was to do nothing, because he had a business to run, and went down to South New Jersey and paid some guy. He bought $250,000 worth of Bitcoin from some guy in a diner in Southern New Jersey. And turned out the guy he was buying it from was a Bitcoin salesman, just a guy, a commission guy. And he said, buddy, next time you want to buy Bitcoin, here's my number. Just call me directly. You don't have to go through these guys. And that's how the scam works. Cost the guy $250,000 in cash. And I'm talking about 10, 20, and $1,500 bills. So, you know, you can't be too careful. You know, and these stories happen, if I'm not mistaken, one of the largest Canadian carriers, one of their divisions, Transforce, it got hit recently. They're a well-run organization. You know, they're the best. They're in class. So, you know, you never know. You just have to be that careful. And yeah, this is the
if,
new...
If we got anybody listening while we're talking about scams, if you pick up a load from a broker and the bill of lading says it's going one place and the broker tells you to deliver it to another, don't trust but verify. I've been running into this scam where some middleman gets a load of expensive something and tells you the bill of lading says to take it to New York, and then you get a call from the broker that says, no, there's a warehouse in Chicago that's waiting on it. And, you know, the carrier that falls for that and doesn't confirm with the consignor or consignee that the reconsignment's legitimate can all of a sudden have to account for why they misdelivered the load.
Wow. Well, wait a minute. I got a question, Hank, because this comes up quite a bit. What if it's a blind shipment?
Beyond the instructions.
That's a very good issue. If you are dealing business with a lumber broker who you know is trustworthy, then you may be able to assume that he has a material interest in it. But otherwise, your bill of lading is a contract, and if it shows it's going to a consignee in New York, you've gotten it off some call board, and some dude you don't know has tendered it to you, and he says to redirect it. That can be a misdelivery. The case law says that you've got to respond to the beneficial owner. And I'm just saying that there are people out there that play this game. I'm familiar with a situation in which the lead broker didn't know that it was copper wire, and he put it on the call boards. And by the time it got handed downstream, the FBI was chasing the copper wire in Chicago, and the people in Happy, New York, were still waiting on it. So I'm just saying that reconsignment or misconsignment really isn't even a cargo claim. You have a hard time getting an insurance company to say it's anything other than negligence.
Yeah, good
so,
point.
Yeah, you know, I'm just saying I have seen that, and you know, this theft, this white collar theft and reconsignment of goods. Is a troubling issue.
Yeah, you know, it makes a lot of sense that people would try to do that. And that's why it's so important, if you're going to be dealing with brokers, deal with people you know, deal with reputable companies, not somebody you got their name in the truck stop and, you know, that you're not familiar with them, you've never heard of them, they have no presence on as a company on social media. You know, just do your homework, because you just don't know today. And there's lots of great brokers out there. It's not like it was 30, 40 years ago when you know, there were so few. There's lots of us. If they're a member of, and I don't know what your thoughts are, Hank, but usually if they're a member of TIA, they've been vetted. you know, that gives you a little bit of idea who you're dealing with. You know, unless by chance you're dealing with a broker that, and I've heard of this before, where they're just stealing somebody's identity. And they all over the paperwork, they put member of TIA, and they're not. You know, they're just a scam. So just do your homework. That's all. Best way to avoid it.
Yeah, and you know, I think you ought to always look out to check the website for the home office number of the carrier or broker when you're working off the web to be sure that the voice at the end of the phone, if he says he's working for CR England, exactly got the, your paperwork runs through Utah, you know, because there are a lot of people, like you say, that appropriate people's names. It's pretty easy to doctor up a certificate of insurance, particularly in the spot market.
People get caught when they're desperate.
Shippers have gotten very fastidious about vetting carriers. Carriers are not so easily able to get a vetting service for brokers. You know, I mean, I participate, I'm sure you guys do, and in some of the bad broker websites and those things,
right.
But it's not half as well organized as RMIS and some of the broker things.
Now, if I'm not mistaken,
right.
RMIS was just bought by DAT, weren't they?
What did you say?
RMIS was just purchased by DAT.
Wouldn't surprise me. DAT has always, anybody that has a load board has always gotten a real vested interest in being sure the crooks are kept off of it.
Right. Of course. That's the whole idea behind it.
I'm looking at the time, gentlemen, and it always goes entirely too fast when we have you on with us, Hank. So I just want to let all of our listeners know if they need any of Hank's services or would like more information that Hank has available to offer, you can go check out his website, www.transportationlaw.net. That's all things for Hank Seaton. Chuck, you want to let good people know how they can get in contact with you?
Yeah, they can give me a call at 1-800-388-4352, and my extension is 203. They can also reach me on email, very easy, just chuck@traffix.com. I do want to mention that one of our listeners called me last week because he was about to sign a contract with a large shipper, and I said, don't you dare sign that contract until you run it by Hank Seaton's office. And he said, well, I've already read the book. And I said, you know what? You're about to sign a binding contract. Spend a few $100 and get one of Hank's lawyers to go over it, because this contract you're about to sign was written by good lawyers that write contracts. So you need to at least have a good transportation lawyer review it. Very important to everyone out there. If you're going to sign direct contracts with shippers, for God's sake, spend a couple $100 and get Hank's office to go through the contract, because they truly understand transportation contracts. And I know this from experience, and they will give you an honest opinion of whether it's good or bad. So it's the best money you're ever going to spend. And with that, I'm going to say thank you, Rico and Hank.
And I'm going to say thank you for the plug.
You
earned
the money.
That's what we have. That's why we have. That's one of the reasons why we have Hank on board, ladies and gentlemen, and the other professionals that we have on board on the show. We try to give you, as I often have said before, we try to give you tools to put in your toolbox. And Hank is one of the critical tools that you definitely need to have in your toolbox. Even though you may have the book and everything else, but when you have a live contract that you're getting ready to enter into, like I said, it's worth spending the $200, $300, even $400, $500 to have it reviewed to make sure that you're not walking into something completely blind. Because if you don't have a law degree, and you don't know how the legal definition of words. You may think that you know a definition of a word, but there's also a very legal definition of words. And if you don't know, understand that, you can go out and try to find you a Black's Law Dictionary and something that you think may mean one thing, and you find out means something totally different.
Exactly.
You don't want to find that out after,
words were never spoken.
After you putting your John Hancock on there.
Yep.
So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for taking time out for joining us here on the Raising Lanes podcast. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time out to hang out with us. We are eternally grateful for that. So with that being said, be safe out there, everybody. Stay healthy. God bless you. Good night. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise, and we'll talk at you next week.
Catch you on the flip-flop.
Night, guys.
Good night.